Hey, what's up, everyone? How you doing? Ben Kissel here. Hope everyone's doing well. Thank you all so much for giving to our Patreon. Without you, we're absolutely nothing. Today, I am honored to have with me, he is a psychologist, a doctor, a fantastic man, and I can't wait to get into it. Dr. Don Castaldi is with me. Dr. Don, thank you so much for being here.
Oh, thank you very much for having me. Appreciate it.
Absolutely. So I suppose the question is, how does trauma correlate with crime? It seems as if these two... psychology and criminology, what have you discovered when it comes to traumatic childhoods, just traumatic life, turbulent existence, and its correlation with crime? Have you been able to sort of marry those two in a more finite sense?
It's a really interesting question. And really what it comes down to is that you end up finding with a lot of violent or abusive offenders, yes, often have a trauma history themselves. The key thing that you want to be able to always state, though, is that people who have endured abuse aren't necessarily going to become an offender.
Right.
So you always go and balance those two things out. So yes, a lot of offenders end up having trauma histories. Once you kind of delve in and get to know them and doing work with them, you discover that. And the science, the responsible piece is to be able to be clear that just because you have a trauma history doesn't mean you're going to become an offender. Mm-hmm. However, we do find that a lot of offenders endure incredible amounts of abuse and those backgrounds. And it's important to recognize that abuse primarily is about power and control. Mm-hmm. And so it doesn't have to be, I'm in prison for domestic violence or assaults or, you know, that sort of piece. So I must have endured physical violence, or I've become a sex offender. So I must have been sexually abused as a child. It doesn't have to be that linear. Mm-hmm. It's about power and control. And unfortunately, people end up finding very destructive ways in order to be able to mend and deal with their histories.
Well, I suppose the irony then is, if it's about power and control, you meet most of these people while they're incarcerated, where they have no power or control. Is there something about the inverse of having power and control that is sort of, I don't want to say enjoyable, but comforting in some ways? Do some people take to the jail system in different ways than others? In other words, do some people almost cling to the unbelievably strict guidelines that seem so inhumane because at the very least, there's some structure?
Absolutely. It really depends on the guy and it depends on the environment. So there's a lot of county level institutions, as well as state level institutions, mm-hmm. that are unfortunately have a lot of corruption in there. Mm-hmm. And they're largely run by gangs inside. And so there, it's kind of like I'm just leaving one gang neighborhood going into another. So for some people, it becomes very clear. And for a lot of guys, you'll end up hearing the phrase, three hots and a cot. And mm-hmm. So in the wintertime, when they're kind of like, you know, don't really have a lot of places to go kind of thing, it's okay to get arrested for a couple of months and do 100 days or whatever kind of thing, just kind of be in and out to be able to have a place to be at, because there's so much of a gang grouping there. Yeah. You also end up finding is that I also... did some work with the Federal Bureau of Prisons, which in the U.S. is all looking at like white collar crime, government sorts of things. And you get a lot of guys coming out of the military system into the federal system. And it's amazing how those guys do cling to that structure. So I had a former client that he was being moved from the military prison environment into a Chicago federal environment after about 12 years. He had committed murder of a prostitute, and it was quite an intense mm-hmm. offense. What was really interesting is because he had this military background, he was like the model inmate. He ran the kitchen. He was a person that was eventually worked his way up to be able to have much more privileges within that environment than your average guy that was in there. And he worked incredibly well within that structured environment. Where I ended up meeting him was within the last 4 or 5 months of his incarceration. And part of that time was that whole assessment of what life's going to be like for this guy without that structure. So you're absolutely right in the sense that you have some people that it does meet their need. Other ones, it just simply perpetuates the criminal environment. And then others, it can be a torturous experience.
Absolutely. And we can talk about that. It reminds me of a slingshot. You know, it's when you leave prison, I watched some prison documentaries, and I did spend one night in the tombs in New York City. But it seems so jarring when they're let out of prison. There is, I mean, I know there's halfway houses and things like that, but many times they're just kind of gone, and you go to the parking lot and you get picked up and you're back to the old environment, which must seem like total chaos.
Yeah.
After being incarcerated, from a psychological perspective, is there any kind of, like, when you spoke with that man 5 months before he gets out, is there any preparation you can do to be like, don't just so you like, do you remember the outside world, the hustle, the bustle? I mean, especially if you're going into a place like Chicago. I mean, this is a city environment. There's options galore. There's millions of people. How do you prepare someone to get back outside? Because, of course, recidivism rates are so massive in this country, and it's heartbreaking because once you get roped into the system, it's dang near impossible to get out. But is there any prep that you can give inside a jail to help someone when they're outside?
You know, it really depends on the offense and what has been allotted by the state or the county to be able to do that preparation. I'm a strong believer in that because for all the reasons that you just talked about, the vulnerability that would end up happening. And if we go back to power and control, if you all of a sudden have somebody just kind of getting let out and going into the parking lot, that person is going to feel incredibly powerless. Their ability to be able to secure employment and things of that nature become incredibly difficult. And so it doesn't take very long to rely upon unsavory kind of sources of you know, for money, for relationships and all that. So if you're able to actually set up a program, depending on the state, you want to be able to get family involved as much as possible. Sometimes family is very estranged from that person, given the amount of time and depending on the offense. And then it's also what sort of resources we can have within the community. And employment is a big deal. You know, if I have a means, if I can have a sense of purpose, right? If I can have an identity other than ex-con, now all of a sudden I have my way to kind of work my way into the real world.
Right.
One of my very first work opportunities was an opportunity to work within a halfway house. And I was part of a pilot project for lifers. So in Canada, individuals serving life sentences, basically life is ends up being like 15 years or 20 years or 25 years. And eventually they allow that person to be out depending on their behavior and risk around recidivism. Basically, Canada abolished capital punishment in the early 70s. And so you can't just house people forever. So how do we have people come back in the community? What was incredibly powerful about that whole experience was that you were dealing with people that were, you know, had missed well over a decade inside being incarcerated and then coming back out. So numerous things, not only just kind of like getting an ID and a bank account and getting those fundamental resources, you'd have things even a matter of crossing the street. So for example, when you're in an institution environment for that long a time, your depth perception changes. So being able to judge the speed of cars and things of that nature, just simply coming on the road can be terrifying because you have no sense that your depth perception is off because you're used to only a certain distance around seeing. That's just one of a million little variables that go into play. And we're not even talking about relationships and having to have relationships with other people of other genders.
Sort of an emotional depth perception as well, I assume.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So an incredible amount of struggle. But the key thing is, if we can get people to end up having some work opportunities, being able to get connected with family resources and create as much structure that way around there, where there's a more of a purpose, there's less likely to be dependent on the other things.
Yeah. You mentioned how some people have just a hellacious time while incarcerated. And I'm interested to hear your psychological approach to dealing with people like that, you know, folks who, I mean, I would not do well. I would be extremely depressed. It would be horrible. How do you deal with those people who maybe they made a mistake, DUI, you know, perhaps you accidentally hurt someone or kill someone and you're a good person and you made a mistake. And those happen all the time. How do you psychologically help someone who is literally going through the worst thing that they've ever experienced and they will be for the next, who knows, 25, 30 years in America, they throw you away and take the key and flush it down a toilet. So how do you deal with those kinds of broken, traumatized people? Can you have any semblance of life?
You know, it's incredibly difficult, and it's really interesting to see where people's own proclivity takes them as soon as they get inside an institution. So, for example, Cook County Jail is an example. There you have, in the receiving area, you literally end up having a bus coming in that may on the weekend have like 200 people coming in. Mm-hmm. Then they have these bullpens that hold about 50 people at a time. And so literally you're in a bullpen with 50 other guys waiting to get processed, and ranging from, like I said, your Wrigley Stadium guys to your serial guys to your gang guys. And so immediately you're being approached in all different ways as to who you're plugged in with becomes the question. What's interesting about those bullpens, because it's meant to be a temporary environment, there's usually only about one toilet in there, open space. It's not like a separate kind of half wall sort of thing.
Right.
And so when in the psychology department, when we're doing our mental status exams, one of the times, sometimes you see guys feigning a lot of symptoms to try and get on the psych ward or try and get in some sort of protective environment. And so it's really interesting, you know, you'd have different measures what people would end up doing to be able to get in that category. And so you'd end up having people just kind of asking for regular services, and then you'd have them doing dramatic things, sometimes self-injurious behavior. Sometimes it would just be incredibly bizarre behavior on purpose to be able to get there, and then being able to keep that and try and feign a mental health symptom. And even if we were really clear that this is clearly somebody who's faking, you could determine almost by how dramatic their feigning of symptoms would be, to say, even though we know that this guy's faking, he's faking to a point where he's putting himself in such peril that we still admit him to the psych ward within the jail. And that other guys immediately jump in with the gangs and immediately try and get themselves plugged in. And unfortunately, that's depending on what their experiences and life experiences are, that can be a very dangerous process for sure.
You know, I watched some videos of psychopathy and sociopathy and people who try to fake it. I watched, the Parkland shooter. I'm blanking on his name now, nor does it need to be said. But he attempted, you know, to act insane, and as well as the Colorado movie Holmes, the movie theater shooter there, as he dressed as the Joker, kind of pretended to be psycho. Or detached. But then I saw actual videos of someone who really is, you know, kind of a sociopath and really disconnected. And I was taken aback by how upfront they were, how they didn't deny any of their crimes, and they really didn't have, it was just bizarre. Can you explain a little bit to the audience, how do you know if someone is really, and I'm probably not getting the verbiage right, so just correct me the verbiage. When it comes to like, how do you know someone really is a sociopath or a psychopath, as opposed to faking it? Like, what are some of the key things where you're like, you know, just how do you deduce that?
Yeah, you know, what's really interesting is that really the, even though there's a lot of talk within the literature around sociopaths, and it's definitely a part of our general language, the psychopath, the actual definition of a psychopath is a personality construct. So it's a personality characteristic as opposed to a mental health sort of piece. And to be able to have that, you have to be able to demonstrate certain characteristics over a two-year period of time. So it's not that you have to assess them over a two-year period of time. It's a matter of looking into their history and seeing their behavior and collecting that information and then using that. So anytime somebody has a personality disorder, there's a criteria that it's not just something that happened on a one-time incident, right? It's something that is recurrent, and there's a considerable evidence to put that in play.
And what sort of, is there an example of an action that you would pinpoint as associated with that?
Sure. The most common is probably there's a particular category when you're doing an assessment around a psychopath called a parasitic lifestyle. And a parasitic lifestyle is literally this, is where you see him that where he may have had numerous relationships, numerous job environments, and each one ended horribly. And not just kind of like, oh, it was a bad breakup. It means that he, you know, may have, you know, stole from them or embezzled money, or he may have, was brutally violent with them. But it was like a really intense taking advantage of people, right? So manipulating of a situation in which they are taking advantage of people. And then once there was nothing left to be able to take anymore, then they just moved on to the next one. Right. So it, there's no sense of remorse. There's no sense of guilt in that process. It's a matter of a parasite finding a host, and to find the host, I'll drain that host of all that they can provide me, whatever that is, whatever I need at that moment. And then I just move on and not have any concerns or qualms or anything about that person, and be able to immediately, you know, kind of brutally attack somebody and then immediately go to an event or go to work or be like, hey, how's it going? And not even give a glimpse about it, right? Not even any sort of cue or response. There's no internalization of those experiences. What's really interesting is I do a training that differentiates between stalkers and psychopaths. And one of the key characteristics, the key differences around that is around this whole idea of parasitic lifestyle and attachment style, where the stalker wants to literally, you know, they overly identify with their victim, right? They, they're completely enamored with them, completely infatuated with them. And they would do anything to stay connected with them. The psychopath couldn't care less. It's very rare to find a psychopath who's also a stalker. It's a very, very rare situation, because the stalker wants to have a relationship, right? They would love to have this maybe unrealistic, maybe not even identified by the victim.
Right.
But they want to merge with that person, you know, almost possess them. The psychopath could not care less. The only time that they want to be connected with somebody is when they're getting something from them. And then they move on once it's finished. The only time you have a psychopath that become a stalker is when that psychopath has been really significantly wronged by that other person. So let's say you they were in a certain role at a job and you were a part of a process that got them fired because they've been stealing or doing something. Now that psychopath is going to maybe overfocus on that person who reported them to get back at them. But it becomes a very purposeful thing. It has nothing to do with having a relationship with them. So that's a key aspect. What we also end up finding in this, when I speak with polygraph examiners, this becomes a, they're always kind of grappling with this aspect. Polygraph examiners often are, law enforcement or people that are associated with law enforcement.
Has that science, the polygraph science, has that improved? Because I know, I know it's not admissible in court, I believe.
That's right.
Is it gotten better or is it still the same old squiggly lines?
Yeah. It's still the same old squiggly lines. I mean, they how it's supposed to be used is more to detect reactions by that person. And it's never meant to be a tool for conviction. So even if you fail a polygraph or pass a polygraph, it doesn't take away from the decision from the court as to what's going to happen within a case, right? There's so many variables that are determined between a prosecutor and a defendant and a judge that make those decisions. And so because polygraphs ends up saying, gives an indication as to whether or not someone may be telling the truth or not, that doesn't determine conviction. And so that's why it's not admissible.
I almost wonder if they never should have called it the lie detector.
That's right. That's right. Well, the thing is that even if you're lying, you might not be lying about, it depends on what you're lying about.
Yeah. So,
And you end up having a physiological response. And really that's what it is, right? It's vital that the machine be able to differentiate between your own anxiety, right? So let's say you have had, you know, a sordid past, but you didn't commit a certain crime that you're being accused of, but now you get hooked up to a machine. And now all of a sudden, you might be feeling quite anxious. Like, hopefully they don't ask me about, you know.
Right. The Walgreens I took a dump in 10 years ago. Yeah.
There you go. there you go. Right. I mean, there's numerous things that end up coming about that can raise your anxiety. So just being able to show that doesn't necessarily mean, that you did it, nor does it automatically say that this particular crime that you had done.
Yeah. So if a true psychopath takes the polygraph, does it just look like they're flatlining? I mean, how does that, how do you infer that this person isn't connecting with the world?
Yeah, you know, it's really interesting that you asked that, because there hasn't been that many studies on it. I'm always trying to encourage people to like new kind of research students to take on this piece. There's been a few studies, and basically they've been all in institutional environments around psychopaths taking polygraphs. So what's interesting is that the average person taking a polygraph, they usually show a spike in their anxiety just before the question is being asked and during the question. There you see the spike in anxiety, right? So all of a sudden the question's been posed. There's multiple questions on how they lead up. So it's usually kind of a pre-question and question time that you see the spike around anxiety. What's interesting for the psychopath, when it's done in an institutional environment, the spike comes after the process is done and after the question's been asked. And that's where the spike comes, and it's very regular. And what it is, and this is kind of interesting, is that is immediately after, the majority of the time, the psychopath would then ask the examiner, did I beat it? Did I beat the test? Right? And so it was an adrenaline rush to see if they could trick the polygraph exam. They weren't anxious about the questions. They couldn't give a, they couldn't care about the question.
Right.
They didn't care about being under pressure. Most psychopaths are have very grandiose senses of self, right? They believe they're the smartest guy in the room, the most powerful guy in the room. So they're not worried about Dr. So-and-so or police officer or whoever. So the spike comes after in a very irregular piece, and it ends up being associated more with the adrenaline rush of the situation. Oh,
pulling off another one.
Yeah.
You know, that's interesting. I want to talk a little bit about mass shootings, because obviously in America, they are an epidemic. But I also, before that, you remind me of, we've been talking a lot about cults. I'm reminded of Nexium, Keith Raniere, watching those documentaries as this person thinks he has discovered a new math, which he did not, because he's not smart. How does psychopathy and the rise of sort of these mini cults, as we've seen them pop, I mean, hell, you can even look at QAnon, it's a macro cult at this point. How have those two things kind of merged in your, like, when you see a Keith Raniere type, like, what do you think? What thoughts do you have about that type of person who convinced a whole bunch of people he knows math better than anyone else that's ever lived, even though the man's a total moron?
Right. You know, what's really interesting is that, you know, if you, I haven't seen any assessments on him to determine whether or not he's a psychopath or not. But when I think about it in general, guys that are in more of that kind of a cult leader sort of position, oftentimes that's a key factor, right? There is grandiose delusions of self. There's also a component there which is sometimes referred to within forensics as a person being a true believer. And when you're doing polygraph exams, you're doing interview interrogation, this is a particular position that the person that you're interviewing may take that becomes, it's a whole new wrinkle and challenge. And the true believer is somebody who 100% believes in exactly what they're perpetuating, right? So they do believe undeniably that they are this kind of godlike messianic kind of person,
right?
And they are there with a purpose, and so you sometimes see this with a lot of religious movements in which it goes in a very dark direction. And it's this kind of true believer piece. And so oftentimes it's not only having a psychopath in that position, but also the people that he's preying upon. So when we look at people who are a part of these groups and who actually get involved in it, a lot of times they come with the backgrounds of being incredibly suggestible, having certain vulnerabilities from an attachment style and what they're seeking within their life that unfortunately are a very unfortunate balance between the psychopath being able to perpetuate that I have the answer and you're looking for that answer, right? So I have lots of questions. This person has lots of answers. And so it's the two, it's the combination of the two that really allows it to grow. You know, you can have a lot of people that they could be in the presence of somebody who's a psychopath, who's very grandiose, it might even have this really kind of charismatic presence. You know, it's not something, that's not a quality that's just sent for people who engage in healthy behavior, right? It's, you could be incredibly charismatic and still be a psychopath. And you might say, hey, what, that was a powerful talk that person engaged in, or that's a powerful thing. And I'm still going to go back to my home, my family, my friends, and I'm going to have other resources, and I can kind of compartmentalize that. And with other people, that might be really seeking certain things within their life, they can become consumed by that, right? Mm-hmm. They can become, wow, this person has the answers. And what's really helpful from the psychopath standpoint is that they see these people and they become all consuming. And it doesn't have to be initially in an abusive sort of way. It can be what's referred to as grooming. And so basically this is about being able to earn the trust of that person in various ways and normalizing the crossing of boundaries. Mm-hmm. And one of the best ways to normalize the crossing of boundaries within a person's life is to have a group of other people, a diverse group of other people that are already buying into it and that say, it's all right. It's not a big deal. This is okay. And so all of a sudden you end up having group thinking, right? You have a group mentality. And we end up talking about, you know, identifying with the aggressor, right? So when I start being dependent on somebody for warmth, guidance, and direction, it's amazing how powerful their influence can be and how challenging it can be to even question it. Mm-hmm.
Why do they always, or maybe not always, just seems like the ones we hear about, why do they turn dark and violent? You know, we talk about like Rock Terrio. We've talked, you know, Jared Leto has like a mini cult out there. Now the actor has like a whole bunch of, he's like a harem apparently. What is it about? Is there something about the innate structure of a psychopath on top and then the inevitability of violence or some kind of dark turn? Or can these things, can you have a peaceful cult in any ways? Like, why do they always seem to get so twisted?
You know, it's interesting that you say that the ones that we hear about, right?
Yes.
And because those are the ones that end up having the behavior becomes so aberrant, so unusual or bizarre or abusive that it ends up getting to the detection, right? So eventually somebody breaks off from the fold, reports it, and all of a sudden we see this piece here. I think it really comes down to, for a lot of guys, so you talked about Rock Theorio there. And if just make sure that we're talking about the same person, he was also known as the Savage Messiah.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
Yes. So, and he's a Canadian guy there. And
yeah, we covered the Anthill Kids and the whole, it's brutal. It's so sad and dark. And yeah, we did a full few episode series on it.
What's interesting about him, but with a lot of people, is you end up having this piece of what can really define you as being godlike, you know, having that kind of messianic kind of presence. And so this is where we start getting into the dark piece. So for him in particular, he ended up believing that he could engage in medical procedures, right?
That was a bad idea, dude.
Yeah. I mean, even when they discovered him, he had his necklace of rib bones.
Yes.
Was of people who, you know, he was unsuccessfully able to complete surgery on, right? And so you end up having, what greater thing can I demonstrate that I'm godlike is if I can do these greater things like surgery or mend you or heal you or transform you. And so you end up start seeing things of that nature. And then you also end up having this whole idea of people within the group that do attempt to differentiate or do attempt to question or to have a any sort of kind of questioning of vulnerability of what's happening. Yeah. And that cannot be tolerated, right? There ends up being a very kind of a swift and quick point of justice, if you will, around such a person who is deviating from the group. And what's interesting with the psychopath, because they don't have the remorse and guilt piece, it's much like the domestic violence situation where you're abusive and then immediately we go into the honeymoon period, right? So you're up on a pedestal, you're in this piece here, now you're getting questioning, so like, I'm going to be abusive, and then we can accept them back. They're fine now. It's all right. You know, they're still believing the old ways. And that's why they were questioning. So you end up having these sorts of structures within those environments.
Is there a similar structure? We can talk about the U.S. mostly, because that's seems like we really got a lockdown on the prison system here. It seems similar to just the macro of our prison system where you get punished, you fall out of line, they punish you more, and then they welcome you back. And perhaps if you get sent to solitary, I mean, the U.S., you can be sent there, you can live there your entire freaking life, which is a nightmare. Is there, like, as far as like a cycle of abuse from a systemic level, and as far as what does that do to the individual, I'm interested to hear, like, you're, you know, you made a mistake again, you go to jail, but you were a relatively normal person. How long does it take before you are eroded because of the psychopath that is the systemic prison system in America? How long does that take before it just alters your brain chemistry and you become almost like a Stockholm syndrome victim?
Sure. You know, I mean, there's no specific number. And like I said, the variability of the person, when you think about systemic racism, and it's a relationship to the penal system, right? Mm-hmm. You end up having somebody who is within the community. They may not have any avenues or resources depending on where they grew up or how their poverty because of their race. And so they end up having alternative means in which they are engaging in criminal behavior in order to make a living or to kind of survive. And then they end up getting pinched and they end up going in the correctional environment. And then in that environment, they're told, well, you have to, you know, be a model citizen and kind of grow. And so you end up saying to yourself, I have no place, right? I have no position in this country, right? In the community, I have no chance and I'm not allowed access and opportunities. And I'm not, you know, I don't have the same access and opportunities as maybe another person. Mm-hmm. And then in the correctional environment, you're perpetuated the American dream sort of piece, right? Hey, you know, if you just make better choices, you can have a better life. And so you end up feeling incredibly, we talk about being disenfranchised, but it's mm-hmm. beyond that, right? It's to a degree in which there's a learned hopelessness. When we talk about helplessness, that's, I want to keep on doing it, but I want to keep on, you know, trying and have a better life kind of thing, but I really don't know how to go about doing it. That's more of helplessness. Hopelessness is, I don't think another training program or therapy technique or this stint, you know, my time in is going to make a difference, right? It's going to be the same story no matter where I go kind of thing. And so there's more about a hopelessness piece. And I think it really comes down to looking at, once again, what possible viable resources that person have to be able to make a difference for themselves, right? To have mm-hmm. purpose and meaning outside of a certain identity and structure, right? And the reality is systemically, there's a lot of pressure that keeps you in a certain lockstep position once you start doing it. We often talk about those guys as maybe not doing life, but doing life on the installment plan, right? They go in and out, in and out, in and out. And you talk to them, they're like, you know what? You know, I went out and I couldn't get this and I couldn't get that. And nobody wanted to be around me kind of thing. So I went to what was familiar to me, right? And it's not necessarily always a matter of persons not learning from consequences. It's more about, do I have enough opportunities and can I create enough opportunities for myself to abandon coping strategies that I once was very reliant on, right? So this is my old lifestyle.
You know, you mentioned hopelessness, and that kind of brings me to the last thing I want to talk about with, again, I'm speaking with Dr. Don Castaldi. When it comes to the youth, being a teenager, hopelessness is a feeling that is constant because it sucks. And you mix that with guns and you mix that with trauma, and you have what we've seen multiple times in this country when it comes to school shootings. Can you explain a little bit of the psychology of the shooter? And, you know, of course, it's not just the youth. You have Stephen Paddock in Las Vegas. He was in his 50s, I believe. What's the psychology behind someone who wants to go and make a splash in the worst possible way, you know, with waves of blood? Can you give a little insight into that? Because it seems to me like a relatively new phenomenon over the past maybe 25 years or so. The shootings seem to be much more regular. What's the psychological aspect of that?
Sure. I mean, and there's such, because there are so many shootings that there's such a diversity of shooter.
Let's focus on if you would like to do Las Vegas, that's fascinating. Yeah. Stephen Paddock, for example.
No, just, you know, for that gentleman there, when you end up looking at his history, he would be more in line with having a profile that would be more akin to a psychopath. Given some of the evidence they were able to, which wasn't a lot, some of the evidence that they were able to put together around his history and his behavior, was a little more consistent with the profile of that of a psychopath. Mm. What you end up seeing with a lot of the school shooters, a lot of the adolescent pieces, sometimes you end up seeing that that early youth psychopathic behavior, which does exist, kind of thing. We saw a lot more with, like, let's say, the Columbine experience back in the 90s. But a lot of times you'll end up hearing this whole aspect around, you know, being bullied, feeling separate from others, being that other person, having some abuse and trauma history. And remember, abuse and trauma history doesn't have to be physical violence, right? Mm-hmm. Emotional abuse, bullying, being ostracized, being shamed, and having that for the greater part of your life ends up skewing people's perceptions and perspectives around what's okay and not okay. You also end up having a level of, when we think about depression, and you think about, like, let's say suicide or suicide attempts is a lot to do with anger turned inward, right? Mm-hmm. But it's still anger, right? There's still an incredible amount of anger and frustration that's going in there. And there's a feeling of, when you look at, I've studied quite a bit around suicide notes in understanding suicidal ideation. And when you look at suicide notes, the majority of them are not that of sending off goodwill to other people, or, you know, it's wanting to get a reaction from their environments, getting a reaction from the people that, within their family, within their friends, to have them feel something for them. Even if it's a distortion around how they think people perceive them, it's still their experience. Mm. What you end up finding often with the shooter piece is that anger is now being externalized. So rather than being an internalized piece in which getting a reaction, it becomes an externalized situation. And a lot of times, you had, as you know, the story ends with the shooter turning the gun on themselves.
Yes.
So there is this sense of suicidal ideation, but there's an aspect of, I'm not just going to leave a note, kind of thing. I'm going to leave a memory. I'm going to leave the ultimate note in which you realize and see me as powerful, as not a victim, as not this, as not, you know, a certain places. And that's for people that don't already have a really pronounced mental health history, like psychosis or things of that nature. Sometimes you end up having people that some of the shooters have had really severe mental health in which their reality testing was off. So that's more of akin towards psychosis. When I say psychosis, I'm referring to, I don't want to say, similar to hallucinations and delusions. Okay. I don't want to associate a disorder with it because I don't want to label a disorder as being associated with that, but people having hallucinations and delusions. Okay. But for a lot of them, it's this level of, they don't necessarily have the hallucinations and delusions, but it's this incredible degree of hopelessness that is not only about themselves and what's going to be happening in their future, but also being able to externalize that to make sure that they are being seen as they want to be seen. And most of the time, even though it's incredibly distorted, it's about, this is how I have power. This is how I have position.
Well, you mentioned how they want to be seen, and we don't need to focus on Eric and Dylan. I hate those two very, very much. They ruined my senior year of high school. Every high school got immediately locked down. I mean, I was in Wisconsin, for crying out loud, and they were the bullies of that school. But when you talk about costuming, I mean, John Holmes dressed like the Joker. And he was obviously, I don't know what the heck was going on, but, you know, he rigged up his apartment so it would supposedly explode. But then, of course, he backtracked once he was caught. What does that, like, how does, I guess the word cosplay, how does that, like, play in? What does the makeup do? Or what are the outfits, like Eric and Dylan wearing the trench coats? And, you know, what does that performative aspect infer to you?
Yeah, it really, to me, it's about being very much so locked into what I would refer to as a narcissistic fantasy, right? So a narcissistic fantasy in which they are going to be able to have influence over other people. And so it literally becomes entrenched within an identity. And so I'm trying to create a persona. And a lot of times you might see them or learn of them having engaged in that persona prior to this. And still it didn't change anything. It didn't change their life. It didn't change their experience. They weren't necessarily more respected. They didn't have the influence that they wanted to. Sure. And so there becomes this incredible distortion further. And unfortunately, you end up having guys that really become consumed within storylines that they're seeing within movies or characters or that they're reading about. And they want to embody what they're interpreting as being all powerful or incredibly mischievous or you know, very cunning, right? Mm-hmm. So, if, you know, so incredibly cunning that they fool anybody who attempts to seek them out or trying to solve them or prevent them from doing what they're doing. Mm-hmm. You know, for the gentleman that dressed up as the Joker, I mean, part of that piece was that he was staying at the crime scenes. You know, he was staying at the crime scenes afterwards. So the police were doing their investigation and he was being noted in photos afterwards as being present at the crime scene. So when the, you know, people are kind of looking around to see what's going on, he was in the crowd. And think about that. If I am somebody who feels incredibly powerless, or I have a presentation that I don't feel is, obviously I haven't had life experiences in which it's been valued in any sort of way. And then I kind of create this situation, and then I see crowds of people and all these authority figures all around engaging in it. That's going to be incredibly intoxicating for that person.
Right? Wow. And really then at any point, does that wear off? Like, we can stick with Holmes just because it's just fascinating. I mean, unbelievably sad. But at some point, as a jail psychologist, do you see people like have stealing a line from Oprah, that aha moment where it's like, that wasn't a good idea in the long run? Or is that just their life? Is that their brain? Is it baked in?
You know, I think you end up seeing those situations changing more with youth than you do with adults. So with youth, I mean, already within adolescence, you're the Mad Hatter with your identity, right? Mm-hmm. You're already going through that identity confusion piece and trying on different personas and that. So developmentally, there becomes a shift there, a natural shift. You know, our brain doesn't fully become fully developed until we're in our late 20s, actually, neurologically. And so there's a developmental shift that naturally occurs there. So you probably see more of that shift with youth. Once they become an adult, being able to create another character or persona or identity for themselves that is healthier. Where you rarely see it is when it's come to that scale, right? Because once it becomes to the scale where you've committed multiple murders or you've engaged in some atrocity of such magnitude, there's not enough avenues to be able to have that shift, right? They're going to be incarcerated for, you know, likely the rest of their life.
Right.
And so those opportunities to have a different is less, for sure.
Yeah,
and it's also important to differentiate between somebody who has given up on a certain identity because they don't have access. They don't have the same temptations or vulnerabilities there. So it's like the pedophile who, you know, has spent 5 years in and they say they went through all the treatment program and they're like, nope, I'm not going to engage in that again. And they've demonstrated through their education that they've thought of a better way. We can't deny the fact that, well, there's no children in this environment.
Right.
There's no opportunity there. And so your ability to be able to make that shift and believe, maybe even genuinely believe that you're going to make that shift, isn't truly tested until you're back in a vulnerable place, right? And having access.
Yeah. It's not going to be the test market for that.
Yeah, exactly. And then that becomes everyone's concern around reintegration and people being released from prison and recidivism. And yeah.
Dr. Don Castaldi, thank you so much for being here. That was fascinating. Thank you so much. Is there anything that you would like our audience to, is there any press? Do you have any books coming out or anything like that? Where can people find you?
Yeah, really my website is where the updates are. And so that's www.dcwaterstone.com. And on my website, I often post different trainings and opportunities. I do trainings for mental health professionals that are often working with trauma and abuse environments. I do a lot of work with law enforcement, polygraph examiners, people who are coming across people with offending environments. And then I also make sure that I dedicate a certain portion of my practice to mental health and also proactive measures. So
awesome.
I have programs all around helping youth within school environments and teaching teachers and
professionals
how to support them in a way that we don't find them engaging in, you know.
Well, I'll tell you, I could have used you in middle school and high school. That's for damn sure.
Live from your grave.
All right. Thanks again to Dr. Don Castaldi. And thank you all so much for giving to our Patreon. We really appreciate you. And we can't wait to see you all on the road very, very soon. All right, everyone, hail yourselves. We'll talk to you soon.